an antenna, you're going to have an antenna with a reasonably low standing wave ratio with a medium good feed line going to it to make a transmitting antenna. To make a receiving antenna, a random length of wire can do it. It's thoroughly non-resonant. The thing, if you put it on a network analyzer, you may find that that clip lead you're using for an antenna probably has a 200:1 standing wave ratio. Because it's not resonant, it's got an effective capture area that's a small fraction of the real resonant antenna that's out in the backyard up in the trees or on the tower. And so how can this work? And the reason for it is that the real atmospheric noise on 80 meters is equivalent to about a 35 or 40 decibel noise figure. In other words, the sky noise is the noise you would get out of a resistor that's running 50,000 degrees Kelvin, hot as all hell. Atmospheric noise on 80 meters is huge. You know that some days the atmospheric noise, particularly at high noon, it may make your S-meter register S8 on the receiver when it's connected to the good antenna. When you connect it to the clip lead, you measure S1. In other words, your antenna has now got, we'll say, 25 dB of lack of efficiency or insertion loss, call it what you like, lack of capture area. It's 25 dB down from a real antenna, but because the noise of the band is 35 dB above threshold of your receiver, you cut it down by 25 dB, the noise is still 10 dB over threshold for the receiver. The signal-to-noise ratio doesn't change because the pattern of your clip lead and the pattern of the dipole in the backyard, if you lay them out parallel to each other, they've got essentially the exact same pattern. You're getting the same ratio of noise and the same ratio of signal, just that both are 25 dB weaker when you're using that non-resonant antenna in the shack with you, the clip lead in my example. So there's one of the explanations for why it appears to be a violation of reciprocity. How come I can't transmit into that clip lead? And by golly, believe me, you cannot. Your rig won't tolerate it, you won't get very much power out of it, and so on. And the guy 5 miles away is not going to hear you when you transmit into the clip lead, even if you could put the power into it. So transmitting, you need a real antenna. Receiving, you can get away with murder. Well, that's the worst case situation, a clip lead connected to the back of the rig. Now, if you're smart enough to take that clip lead, wind it into a coil, and resonate it. The magic of resonance is the size of the antenna almost does not matter as long as it's resonant. That's part of what's going on with that ferrite loop stick antenna that's in your AM transistor radio. Your AM transistor radio, when it's listening to winds 1010 New York at 1.01 megacycles, that's a 300 meter wavelength, 900 foot long wavelength, if you're going to make a half-wave dipole on that frequency, it would be 450 feet long for a half-wave dipole. Obviously, you're not going to put a half-wave dipole in a transistor radio and put it in your pocket. So they build this ferrite loop thing, which picks up the H field instead of E field, but it still resonates it. And once it resonates the ferrite loop stick, you get the magic of a great big antenna. If you want to get one step deeper into the theory of what's going on, you read the appropriate chapter of Krause's book, Antennas, McGraw-Hill Publishing Company, 1950, one of the Bibles on the subject, and you read Krause's, W.H.A.K. is the head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio University for a whole lot of years. I think he's the founder of the Electroscience Laboratory out there, a very high-class group of people, a very good laboratory to this day. Anyhow, he wrote this book in 1950 that's a classic, and you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. And what is John Krause telling you? W.H.A.K., a guy who cut his teeth in wireless radio by way of ham radio, and he became one of the world's best experts on radio and the head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio University. Well, how did he find this all out? He discovered that if he took a half-wave dipole and made it smaller, somewhat like what some of us have done here, Bob is getting close to that with the experiments he's doing with altitude and parasitic wires, but if you make the dipole shorter, but you put loading coils in it in the center of the dipole, or you put top hat capacitors on the tip of the dipole, the shorter dipole can be brought back into resonance. It becomes a little bit more narrowband, but still at your tuned frequency, it will give you full 98% performance. And how far can you take that experiment? You can make the dipole shorter and shorter and shorter, and you do more and more heroic things to bring it back into resonance. But as long as you bring it back into resonance, and as long as the techniques you're using have low insertion loss, high Q coils, no series resistance in them, use quality materials, as long as you take that dipole and bring it back into resonance, even if it's only a few percent of the proper length, you come back to the full gain, the full capture area. That's the magic of resonance. When you make the dipole short, instead of the signal bouncing back and forth 30 times before it gets radiated, and by the way, that infinitesimal dipole, you can transmit through it, as long as it's resonated and properly impedance matched. That signal has to bounce back and forth, not 30 times like it does with a full half-wave dipole, but it's now got to bounce back and forth a few hundred times. But as long as it stays in step, and that's what resonance means, you come back to the full effective capture area. And that's a tough one to swallow. There's a lot of mystery to what goes on with wireless, and this is one of the beautiful mysteries. If your eyes operated at that frequency, so that you can look at your full half-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132 beautiful feet long, and you look at that oval of space around that dipole, that is its effective capture area, that oval of space around the dipole is 8,500 square feet of real area. If your eyes operated at that frequency, you'd see a big oval of black hole where all of the 80-meter signals coming at the right polarization, the right frequency, the right direction, get sucked up by that 8,500 square feet. All of that energy in that wave coming to your backyard, 8,500 square feet of it, gets sucked up by that dipole. It goes down your feed line, and it moves the decimeter on your receiver. You make that dipole, instead of 130 feet long, you make it 30 feet long, but re-resonate it. Instead of 8,500 square feet, you've got 8,200 square feet. You lose 3/10 or 4/10 of a dB. That's all. And it comes back to the exact same gain, pattern, and effective capture area. That's the magic of resonance. So, the effective capture area of a real electronic antenna versus the thing that you see with your eyes can be unrelated as long as you're smart enough to establish resonance. This is a truth that Mel and I are slowly discovering after 30 some odd years of working with radio. The books that are written on the subject don't make this concept clear. There's hints of it there. John Krause was telling you this when he got his chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. There are other articles that have been published in Antennas and Propagation in which they try to talk about the scattering area and the effective capture area of various kinds of antennas that are small and large and in and out of resonance. They give you hints, but nobody has put it all together. Mel and I and others are slowly discovering a little bit about what's going on, and you're hearing it. You're hearing the story as it's developing is one way of looking at it. You haven't heard the end of the story yet. I guarantee some of you guys have got some questions on this. If so, give us your call letters right now. KQLAW on the TechNet. My goodness, we're putting him to sleep tonight, Mel. Now, have I gone down the list of everyone who signed in who thought he had a question? Did anybody change their mind and say they've got a question? If so, will you give me your call letters and your name right now? KQLAW.
It's 2EO6.
Question?
Okay, we got both N2EO and QIQ. Anyone else?
WB2CUK Mobile.
Okay, there's another guy who's been on radio for a long time. Bill, we're going to get to you in that order. Okay, we got more than enough. Rich first. Does any part of the story sound fantastic to you, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW in the group.
I want to know from now, if you got my M2 or the Empire back to the M2.
Yeah, we're hearing your audio. You've got good, clean signal-to-noise ratio there, Rich, so we're hearing your audio pretty well, and we know you're having quite a bit of trouble with your throat there. Now, that ISO loop you're talking about and the Isotron antenna, which was popular 10 or so years ago, was an extremely small structure. You located it in the shack with you. Each time you QSY'd more than 100 kV, you had to re-resonate it. It's a high Q antenna. But I say it gave you full performance. However, the people using, buying, and talking about that antenna did not have the confidence that it could work well because it was a small antenna compared to the full 131-foot dipole in the backyard on 80 meters. They assumed it was lower in performance. They didn't bother comparing the two, and they lost the faith. They didn't realize that other than the fact that it maybe wasn't the right number of feet off the ground, so it gave them the right vertical angle of radiation, so they could work DX with it. I mean, except for the altitude, which is something you can't blame on the antenna, that is you, the installer, except for that, that Isotron, that Isoloop, they were capable of giving you full performance. You put 100 watts into the antenna, and 98 watts got radiated into space. What more do you want? And it came out with a pattern that was predictable. What more do you want? And if you wanted the full performance, you have to mount it at the right altitude. Maybe not in the shack with you, unless you happen to live on the 14th floor of a good apartment complex. But we haven't given a fair shake to these smaller antennas. The whole concept is not understood. Mel gets a hell of a lot of flack when he tells his buddies on 80 meters what he's doing and what success he's getting with it. He gets hate mail from his email when he describes it. The guys on the band say, yeah, Mel, tell us another story. You're testing our gullibility. The story is too fantastic to start digging into the details. He's on to something, and, every maverick and every point in time, the guy who's doing something that's a little bit different, everyone tells him he's crazy. The day will come when you'll stop telling him he's crazy. Hey, Glenn, what do you think about all this? KCQ, QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Welcome to the W2L repeater.
K2RIW, KCQ, QIQ. Most of everything that you've been saying so far, I've been able to kind of experiment with gear and kind of prove out the same. It seems to be working. Except my question tonight is something about the polarization of the antenna. And what I've been finding is that they make the antenna shorter. Yes, I can make the matches. I get them to radiate very, very well. They seem to work. Some seem to work better than others. But what I've been finding is that when I have an antenna that I think is working poorly, a lot of times it's really just how it's mounted. So I started looking at polarization of the antennas. And my question tonight is, what's a really good way of measuring the polarization? I'll tell you what I've been doing, and I don't know if it's really valid or not, is that I have someone, another licensed hand in my station, key up the transmitter identifier or try to hold a QSO while I'm outside with an RF field strength meter and trying to, with the width and the vertical or the horizontal position, try to determine, you know, what kind of a pattern and what kind of polarity polarization is coming off of the antenna and trying to, you know, kind of walk around the property, around the block, so to speak, with the receiver and kind of just try to determine that. Is there a better way of doing it?
You're on to exactly the right way, Glenn. If a person from the radiation laboratory of MIT was being asked the question, Dr. Glenn, we're not going to tell you the nature of the signal. We're just telling you it's on 3.5 megacycles or 7.2 megacycles. There's a signal. We want you to tell us its E field and its magnitude. And he would go out there with a standard piece of test equipment, which might be a resonated small dipole. It might even be just a simple E-field probe into a FET amplifier, where he's measuring the E-field without absorbing power from it. That's sort of what your digital voltmeter does. Your digital voltmeter with a 10 megohm input impedance and an amplifier inside doesn't really suck out power from your battery when you're measuring the voltage, like your old vacuum, your old OM used to do. Your triplet 630 really sucked power out and really moved that stop and dial movement. Nowadays, the DVM doesn't do that. But you can buy or build simple instrumentation that will measure the E-field, and you change the orientation of the antenna, and you say, yeah, when I hold the antenna horizontal, I get 5 volts per meter. When I hold the antenna vertical, I get 0.5 volts per meter or less. Most likely, that's a horizontally polarized signal. By measuring the magnitude of the E-field in volts per meter, or measuring the power that's coming by you in watts per square meter, whichever unit you like, you're measuring how strong it is and its orientation. It's a polarization. So you've got at least two techniques for measuring polarization, Glenn. The real physical experiment that you just did, and that takes into account the effect of the house. If you've got the antenna in the basement, and it's alongside of the water pipes and alongside of the plumbing of the house and whatever, and that's maybe disturbing the E-field, and you want to know what's radiated in the space, but you go into the backyard and the far field from the antenna, so to speak, and make measurements. One experiment is good, is better than a few thousand theories, has often been said. The second approach would be, as you get smarter and smarter, and you build up experience, and you say, gee, I've resonated this coil, and the coil is a leaky radiator, it's a kind of an antenna. Eventually, you'll be able to look at the antenna with your RF eye, EYE, and say, yeah, I know the polarization. But when in doubt, make the measurement. You've got the right idea. And so you've done the right thing, and isn't it an interesting science? Now, when it comes to polarization, we all keep forgetting over and over again that when that signal goes to the ionosphere, and the majority of the signals that you talk to on anybody except the guy that's in your town, when you want to go beyond your town, 98% of the time, you are using the ionosphere. Either the signal is going straight up, hitting the ionosphere, and coming back down a small distance away, small meaning like Pennsylvania or New Jersey, if you're a guy in Massapequa, for instance, near vertical incident skywave signal, or if you talk to the guy in DX, you're using the ionosphere. In all of those experiences, the ionosphere will experience Faraday rotation. You can't stop it from happening. The ionosphere is a conducting medium called a plasma. It's got ionized particles where the electrons and the protons have been separated from each other. That's what a plasma is. That's why the ionosphere does its thing. That's why it affects the radio wave. That's why it's a bouncing-like structure. It does something more complicated than that. It really absorbs and re-radiates, but it looks like a bounce. But that signal, when it's the plasma of the ionosphere with a simultaneous Earth magnetic field, whenever you've got a plasma with a magnetic field in it, it will do Faraday rotation. That means you launch a horizontal signal into the ionosphere, and at your particular frequency, the ionosphere might twist the signal 3 times before it comes out of that ionosphere at some other polarization. And the polarization that comes out of that ionosphere changes minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day. It's a function of what is the sunspot cycle doing, where is the gray line, is the sun above the horizon, below the horizon, how many hours ago, what angles you go into the ionosphere with reference to the Earth's magnetic field, how far away is the DX, how many bounces does it make to get that signal over there to Europe, and so on. We all keep forgetting about the randomness of polarization. A hell of a lot of the QSB fades we all experience on HF are because the polarization rotated during that minute of time, and the signal faded because your antenna didn't have the right polarization. Mel is discovering with his loop in the shack with him, where he can easily steer it mechanically in azimuth, elevation, and polarization, he can peak it up for the best signal-to-noise ratio. It may be a weak signal on the S-meter because his antenna is low down, close to the ground. He doesn't have a great angle of radiation. But because he can peak the angle of arrival, because he can peak the polarization for the state of the ionosphere today, he is taking full advantage of everything Mother Nature is giving him as far as that signal that comes into his backyard. He is adaptable. We don't read about that. We don't talk about that. I'm amazed. For this many years downrange, we all think that signal goes into QSB phase because the ionosphere temporarily disappears, or we think the signal hops over our town and doesn't go there, and we're in the dead zone. I'm beginning to think that a high percentage of the time, the dead zone that you think you go through when that signal goes into a phase is a polarization phase. And if we're smart enough to build a horizontal and a vertically polarized antenna, and we flip back and forth between the two, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that more than half the time, what you think is a QSB fade is not a fade at all. Another whole area that we don't talk about and for further experimentation. I wonder what you think of all this, Glenn. KT2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm discovering exactly what you're saying, because I've got two types of antenna setup. One is a beam that I'm able to mechanically rotate from the horizontal to the vertical side. And generally, if I start having problems with any kind of perception or contact, I just basically start rotating the antenna. But in most general terms, either the vertical or the horizontal, I find very, very rarely that there's something like in between, like 45 degrees, that would work better. But what's oddly enough is that on the wire antenna is where I seem to have the strangest kind of performance with polarization. I found that some of the antennas that were giving me the best reception and transmitting antennas were even low to the ground. And that's when I started measuring polarity to see if I could find out something there. And I found that even if the wires were laid relatively horizontal to the ground, I was getting strong vertical polarization. That's why I'm kind of asking the first question about, is that an accurate measurement? If I'm getting strong vertical polarization, even 100, 150 feet away, does that mean that it really is vertical, which I was suspecting that it was? But the odd thing is that the antennas that were giving me strong vertical polarization seem to have less of those fading effects than the wire antennas. And when I started taking the dipole and raising it high enough in the air so that eventually it started giving me a strong horizontal polarization that I could measure, then I started noticing some other things that it would have a more directional effect, and I would have more of those fading effects with the dipoles that went higher. Any possible clues to what that is?
Yeah, I got a couple of clues, but I'm not positive. First of all, we all talk about our antenna, and sometimes we talk about the feet off the ground of altitude of the antenna, and we think that fits. If your eyes operated at 80 meters or 40 meters and you looked at the environment, you would see a real antenna above the ground and a mirror image of the antenna below the ground. At 80 meters, that soil in your backyard is a slightly foggy mirror, but it's a darn good mirror. And there is a real opposite polarization mirror image antenna below the ground, the same number of feet as your antenna is above the ground, and both are radiating. That's what's really happening. If you stood a mile away from the antenna and you looked back at it with a set of eyes that worked at 80 meters, you would see the real antenna, the mirror image. You're seeing the mirror image because a quarter of a mile in front of your antenna, the signal is reflecting off the flat Earth. Well, that's what's really happening. And it's as if there was a mirror image, a virtual antenna below the ground, the exact same number of feet you got above the ground. As you bring the antenna closer and closer to the ground, the Earth becomes more of a dummy load. It starts absorbing the wave, and what gets left over, sometimes it's the vertical polarization. The Earth is nowhere near as efficient at absorbing a vertically polarized wave compared to a horizontally polarized wave. Your signal is putting out some vertical and a whole lot of horizontal, even though it's a horizontal wire. I mean, your feed line does a little bit of the radiating and so on. And as you bring the antenna close to the ground, a hell of a lot of the horizontal gets absorbed and not as much of the vertical, and so the resultant polarization could be more vertical even on what you think is a horizontal antenna when you look at the big picture. There's also the possibility that when you make the measurement 100 feet away, the strongest component is vertical. You need to make the measurement a mile away at the right altitude. It may be a slightly different answer. RF is like that. Strange stuff. But fascinating, as you can tell, and it's not clear what all is going on. And lots of books have been written on the subject. None of them make all of this super clear. I'm still baffled by how those astronauts on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 that I personally listened to, with hardware that I put together with my own hands, and they're on the moon transmitting a signal at the 2,000 megacycles, and there's nothing between that moon and the Earth but the hard vacuum of space. Not a single molecule of any kind is there, for all practical purposes. There always are some spare molecules. but compared to down here on Earth, there's nothing in that hard vacuum of space. Not one single electron left that antenna on the moon. Some photons, whatever they are, flowed from that antenna, came down to Farmingdale, where I was located, got picked up by my 12-foot dish, and eventually came out of that loudspeaker, and I'm listening to astronaut audio from astronaut Irwin on Apollo 15. And I'm saying to myself, gee, this is fun, but what the heck is really happening? What moved through space? It's nice to give it a name, like photon, like the word virus. You give it a name, but you don't really know what's going on. So here I am, 30-some-odd years into radio, and I'm still awed by it all. I'm still amazed by it all. I only partially understand it, even though it's been my passion for 30 years. So it's a great science. It's a great hobby. You ain't seen nothing yet. I better go on to Bill. We've been keeping him waiting. Bill, what would you like to say about all this, or what would you like to ask? And Bill, I haven't got it all figured out, but you've been to a lot more flea markets than I have. You've talked to some smart people. Maybe you've got it all figured out. Hey, Bill, why don't you straighten me out on this one? WB2CUK, K2RAW on the TechNet.
Hi, good evening, Dick, K2RAW, WB2CUK. Good timing. I was mobile and I just got in, so I can talk a little bit. I had a question. No, I agree with what you've been saying about the antennas, about the resonant and non-resonant working equally well with the receiver. It is kind of strange, because you know if you try and load a transmitter into a 6-foot piece of wire at 80 meters, it's not going to work. Of course, a light bulb will work, but I don't think the impedance of a light bulb is exactly 50 ohms either. I think it's probably a little higher, 100-watt bulb. What's the question I had to you, I've heard this mentioned, I don't know if it's myth or fact, yeah, let's say, like you were talking about AM on 1010 winds, and they transmit a signal, and you tune that signal in, and you had mentioned sucking the signal out of the air. If you tune to that station, another person does, and 50,000 people tune to that station, would the signal for the 50,001st person who tunes that be any less than if no one listened? In other words, if no one was listening, would your signal be what you got stronger, what you would receive would be stronger than the 50,000 people tuning in, and would that attenuate a transmitted signal? Say from a distance of maybe 30 or 40 miles. How does that sound? That's a good question. Back to you.
Boy, is that a good question. Hey, Bill, you ain't going to be happy with this. The answer is yes and no simultaneously. Let me explain this one. As a scientist, if I take a cup of water and I pour it into the ocean, in theory, I can calculate the new altitude of the tide because I've added a cup of water. It may be a micrometer higher, but I can calculate that. I know how much area the Earth has. I know how much water is there. Very rough approximation. I know I'm adding an extra cup of water. And yes, is the tide going to be higher? I guarantee you can't measure it, but theoretically the answer is yes. Now let's go to that Wind 1010 station, which I think used to be located in New Jersey. And they're transmitting 50,000 watts of power. Your little AM radio needs one micro-microwatt of that power to be happy. And if I compare that one micro-microwatt of power that your radio sucks up compared to the 50,000 watts they're radiating, if I had billions and billions of people in your town all tuning to that radio station at the same time, and you're in the middle of that crowd, and you measure the strength of what you get versus when they're not there, without a doubt there's going to be a difference. And in that case, you'll measure the difference. And your first assumption is going to be, well, they're all tuned to the signal, they're sucking up the signal, and that's why it's a little bit weaker. It's a half a dB weaker than my receiver when these thousands of people are in my town and I'm in the middle of the crowd and I'm tuning to the same station they are. You do that experiment and you'll get that as an answer. There's more to it than meets the eye. If you then do the experiment, you have those thousands of people in your town and you're in the middle of the crowd, and they don't even have their radio turned on. It's in their pocket and it's turned off. You're still going to see 0.4 of a dB of less because the human beings are an anechoic material. They're a dummy load, and they're sucking up some of the signal because they're around you. Let me show you how this has happened over and over again. at AIL for a whole lot of years, they used to hold something called the John Dyer Memorial Seminar. Once every year, you would bring a bunch of smart people together in a great big auditorium, and the guys that are doing pure research of some kind, or they're investigating a brand new product they want to sell, would give you a 15-minute discussion on what they're doing, and the crowd would sit there and watch. At the end of the 15-minute talk, had a 5-minute question and answer period. During the question and answer period, they'd walk around the crowd with a wireless microphone. They'd hand it to the person in the audience. You got an audience of 1,000 people, and the guy in the middle of the audience is asking a question to the guy at the podium who just gave the talk, and you want to find out, hey, did you use a 50-ohm resistor when you did that experiment? You know, that's your question. Okay. Poor old Philip Smith was the guy who was in charge of the audio-visual department setting up that microphone. Year after year, he would set up the microphones in the auditorium, and they worked like a charm. He puts 1,000 people in the audience, and all of a sudden the microphones have got huge cop-outs because the people were sucking up the signal. And the signal wasn't getting to the antenna that was in the corner of the room with that little wireless microphone in the middle of that crowd. And year after year, he would set it up and test it, and it worked like a charm when the audience was not there. And he puts the audience there, and all of a sudden the microphone has got dropouts again. He needed a distribution of receiving antennas around that auditorium to get around the fact he needed microcell sites, if you know what I mean, because the people were sucking up the signal. So if you did that experiment, Bill, the people sucking up the signal is the greatest thing you would absorb, what you would observe. I bet it's different than you expected. WB2CUK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it certainly makes a lot of sense, and I certainly would understand that at UHF and VHF frequencies, because I know the placement of my antenna in the room, well, no matter if there's anyone here or not, makes a vast difference on how I receive the repeater, which would then again conversely or obversely affect how the signal gets into the repeater. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense there, because something I never thought about. So if you eliminate the 50,000 people and their radio, this signal would be stronger. All right, I'll let you get on to some other people. I have some bags to unpack here, and I enjoy listening to you then. WB2CUK.
WB2PNJ, question on this.
PNJ and KEY both. Bill, I am guessing you came back from a flea market. Which flea market did you go to? How many people were there? What great bargains did we miss? And give us a couple of words on that one, Bill, if you're still there, Bill.
No, I did not come back from a flea market. My wife has been in a rehabilitation center up in Woodbury. She's been there since Thanksgiving, and I've been going there every day and coming back every night about this time. This is my last night. Tomorrow she's getting out. No flea market. There is one coming up on, I think, the 4th or 5th of January out in Seaford, and there's also one in, I forget, Marathon, New York. I don't know if that's the first weekend of January or the second. I have to look it up in on the web, but I don't know if Gail and I are going to do that. I want to give her a chance to recuperate and be here at home, and if she feels strong enough, we'll definitely be a live off show. But no, Dave, sorry to disappoint you. No missed bargains this weekend. Back to you.
B2HWW with a comment.
Howard, you're on the list also. Bill, what's the name of the flea market in Seaford next weekend, I think you said, or in the middle of January? Who's running that particular flea market in Seaford, Bill?
That'd be the first Sunday in January. I think that looks like today's the 30th. That'd probably be like the 3rd or 4th. That's the Antique Wireless Association. They get together in the parking lot of the speaker repair house. He also does antique radios there on Sunrise Highway. It's about a quarter of a mile east of the Seaford Oyster Bay, right there on Sunrise Highway, next to Wendy's. And they get about 10 guys. You know, that's the one that used to be out in Ronkonkoma.
Very good. We got some people who are very heavily involved in the antique wireless. They're going to like that one. I think the next person with a question was Mel, K2KEY. Go ahead. And by the way, I forgot the other person other than Howard that signed in, Mel. You got better memory than me. Tell me who it was. Mel first. Go ahead.
Somebody else wanted to ask a question on this subject. Go ahead.
This is Bob, W2PNJ. Just something along that line, a little different, but I'll wait my turn.
Okay, you're right after Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, you got Howie, too, on there. Don't forget Howie. well, you know, there was an article some years ago I don't know if it was, you know, more of a just a comment of, about the high tension lines that run through areas upstate New York over farms and all. And one of the, remember, one of the articles was written that somebody up there said that he was able to pick up the power from these high tension lines, you know, these hundreds of thousands of volts going overhead, and pick it up and actually use it to light up, lighting up his barn some way or another by connecting it to two sheets of metal on the roof. Now, I was curious, can, if he turns the lights on, is it even, I know, an infinitesimal amount of power compared to what's going over those lines, but could you say to me that you could actually, if we had the right instrument, could we measure that there is loss in those power lines up there, if he's capable, really, of getting enough power to light up a bulb in his barn, Dick, over?
Okay, there's a number of hidden questions on that whole situation here, Mel, and it's an interesting situation, and there's been a lot of hype on this one. A good science student, a guy with a master's degree in electrical engineering, where you tell him I'm running a 138 or a 330 kilovolt line, and it's on towers that are 160 feet tall, and there are three wires with the three phases, and they're all separated by 60 feet from each other. You give that raw information to a good science student, or even a good guy like us who's willing to dig into it. I mean, you take a guy who's willing to study how a crystal lattice filters work, and he's willing to go out and buy a whole lot of filters and tune them and measure the Q of each one of them and put them in married sets and make fantastic filters. I mean, any of these subjects, if we get sufficiently interested and we start doing some research and Google searches and reading Wikipedia and reading the right book, we can become smart in almost anything except brain surgery. I just think that's a little bit beyond our capability, but we can acquire the knowledge. What I'm trying to say is that a science student can tell you for each size of metal plate, X number of feet above the ground, how many volts will appear on the plate, and if you start loading down that plate, how many amps of current or milliamps of current you can get out of it. Or if you put a magnetic loop of a known size and a known orientation below that high tension line, how much power can you suck up? That is a calculatable situation. That situation, in my mind, is deterministic. You know the geometry, you know the voltage. Typically, these 135 kilovolt lines, 330 kilovolt lines, run approximately 1,000 to 5,000 amperes through the wire. You know the voltage, you know the current, you can calculate the E field, you can calculate the magnetic field. You can therefore calculate what size of coil or what size of metal plate is going to pick up how many watts of power. My gut feel is that if you did the experiment, you did it correctly, you can get tens of watts and maybe hundreds of watts with reasonable instrumentation that you can put on your farmer's field underneath those high tension lines. It's an interesting experiment. Can you get enough power compared to the tens of kilowatts you use when you turn on your microwave oven or your regular thermionic oven and all the lights and the air conditioning, everything else in your house? Are you really going to run your house off of that? I think the answer is absolutely no. But you can get some power out of it, and the amount of power you can get is calculatable. And will the power company know the difference if you keep quiet about it? No way in hell. I mean, they're running megawatts, and you're taking out a couple of watts. I mean, they couldn't resolve that difference compared to a dry day versus a high humidity day, where the leakage across all of their porcelain insulators changes substantially, and sometimes on a salty atmosphere, on a high humidity day, you get arcing across those porcelain insulators, and you and I can hear that arcing, and on a dark night, you can see the corona discharge across those porcelain insulators. The power being discharged there is huge compared to what you would be sucking up if you were doing this experiment in your backyard. Could they resolve the difference if you were keeping quiet and not putting it in the newspaper? They would never know the difference. And you could get away with it for years. But you're not going to get a whole lot of power from that one. And let me show you another parallel experiment that's going on right now. Lots of people are building handheld RFID readers and handheld barcode readers and whatever. And they all run on batteries, and you've got to recharge the batteries. Various companies are now starting to advertise wireless charging circuits. Now, if you've got something that looks like a large wall wart that you plug into the socket in the wall. It's got a large coil to it, and you locate a similar coil connected to your handheld device, and you locate it nearby, and by induction magnetic field, you couple enough power to charge the battery easy. The implication by some of these companies now is that you install a coil in the ceiling of your house, install a coil in the floor of your house, and now whenever you operate your handheld device in the turned-off mode, the coil inside your handheld device will pick up enough of that magnetic field so that it will be doing charging. Every time I do a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation of that, I come to the conclusion that the milliwatts of power I can absorb in that manner and the rate at which I can charge the battery is so darn small that it's almost not worth the effort. If I'm locating the device an inch away and I put it in the holster at the long side of the wall wart, yeah, I can get watts of power because I got close coupling. But the way magnetic field falls off at a 60 hertz rate, it's very difficult across the 10 feet from floor to ceiling to get enough strength of H field or E field to do wireless charging. And if you made that field strong enough, you're getting dangerously close to the point where it represents a radio frequency of super low frequency, radio frequency biohazard to the people that are in the room. Because human beings are, from a radio point of view, a human being is a bag of salty water. That's what that blood and everything else, protoplasm in your body is. You are quite conductive, obvious by the fact you put your fingers across on a 10-volt line, you're going to feel the current that flows, and it's going to give you an electrical shock. You are a conducting surface, substance. You give me a strong enough 60-cycle magnetic field, and the conduction that's going on inside my body is going to do some things that might not be good. And there is, according to the American National Standards Institute, the ANSI C95 standards, there are ratings for E field and H field that you're not supposed to exceed at everything from 60 hertz up to 300 gigahertz in order to be safe for human beings. And so you make a strong enough magnetic field to easily charge your device in a wireless manner, you're getting dangerously close to those recommendations that should not be exceeded, the maximum permitted exposure of that particular document. So that whole approach has limited application, in my opinion. Another thing that's going on here that complicates the situation is that if I was building a transmission line for, let's say, channel 2, 54 megacycles, and this was the year 1960, the 300-ohm twin lead with a half-inch spacing is a very well-shielded transmission line, even though it looks like open wire line. If the frequency is low enough, and if the spacing between the wires is a small enough fraction of a wavelength, it's a very well-shielded transmission line. You come all the way down to 60 hertz, and you put equal current of three phases through the three wires that are separated by 60 feet on that 330-volt high-tension distribution line, transmission line, that's going across your farmer's field. Those three wires with the 320-degree-apart phases constitute a three-wire twin lead, three-wire tri-lead, you could call it. It's a reasonably well-shielded transmission line. The amount of external E field and external magnetic field that you can sense from that 150 and 250 feet away is a hell of a lot smaller than you think it would be because it's almost a shielded transmission line. So that's going to drastically decrease the amount of power you can suck up that way. So once again, I think it's an interesting science experiment. The total amount of power you're going to get without using heroic techniques is, in my opinion, very small. And will the power company know about it? I think no way in hell. That's my opinion on that one. I think that was your question. Maybe I went a little far afield on that one, Mel. K2KEY, I think, is the guy who asked it. K2LAW in the TechNet.
W2TGT.
Everybody, 1 minute. No, question was, Dick, that if a person actually was able to do this experiment, in other words, actually light up a bulb, say the farmers underneath there in their barn, and capable of lighting up these bulbs, if a lot of farmers all down the line, let's say along the hundreds of miles of these towers that run across their land, if every one of them turned on, was able to do this, would the power company say, gee, this is something going wrong here? And let's say they could all together draw, you know, thousands of watts. Would they be able to detect it, first of all? And if so, do you You know, in other words, would they have any leg to stand on that you are using our energy, you're not paying for it? In other words, is it possible that that you will see a difference in the in other words, in the consumption, let's say, on their line, Dick, over?
How about Tesla?
Yeah, Tesla tried to transmit power wirelessly, and he used heroic techniques, and he wasn't able to transmit very much power, very much distance. And the situation has a little bit of parallel situation with what was happening with the early days of television receive-only terminal satellite receiving systems with the 12-foot dish way back in, let's say, 1975. What was happening in 1975 is the FCC and other agencies was trying to control the situation, trying to license all the ground stations, and the guys that were setting up systems in their backyard and picking up that signal, the FCC was using intimidation techniques, telling you what you were doing is illegal. In reality, what it finally boiled down to, in my opinion, was that those satellites were putting a signal into your backyard you did not ask for. As long as you're sucking up that signal with equipment you built with your own hands as a science experiment, and you're consuming that material in your own home and not charging admission, in my opinion, you were breaking no rules. Lots and lots of guys were doing it. Almost none of them ever got prosecuted. By the same token, if lots and lots of farmers were doing this, they could, first of all, get a very good lawyer and convince the court that that power company put a magnetic field and an E-field in your backyard that you did not ask for, and therefore you started using it. Now, in reality, what really happens is that you get a large number of farmers doing this, and they're going to start bragging about it. The word will leak out. You can't get that many people keeping a secret. Because it starts getting into the newspapers and starts becoming public, and the power company starts realizing that, hey, this situation is getting a little bit out of hand. It's almost like somebody's starting to tap into the cable company and becoming a scop law, and if a lot of people start doing it, all of a sudden they're losing revenue, and they're going to start reacting accordingly. And they're going to call you a cable stealer. I forget what the words they used for that. So can you get away with it if you start doing it large scale? Of course not. That's my opinion. Gordon, what do you think about all this? W2TTT, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I'm at Dick. It's not legal.
Yeah, in the bottom line, I agree with you. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not legal, W2TTT. But as a practical matter, if you coupled energy off of the power transmission line in the amounts you're talking about, even if it was hundreds of farmers with fairly large scale, you know, infrastructure doing that, my guess is that it would still fall within, shall we say, the statistical noise floor of losses, of measured losses, that are normally experienced in power transmission as a function of weather. As you suggested, so I just don't see that as a big deal. Where I see it to be useful, actually, is for a farmer or some other person underneath such a line who might want to run a pump or some other thing, charging up some batteries to provide some stability in what otherwise might be a tenuous situation. So, I think I might be inclined to do that, actually, as a backup power system, tap off that, charge the battery bank with it, so as to run, a sump pump or something, as a hedge against that. But or even an irrigation pump. If you had crops that have to stay irrigated, let's say you were running hydroponics or something, I could see that being a possibility as well. Anyway, the bottom line is it's probably illegal and people need to go to jail for it. But if, you know, rights of way are very funny about that, and things that are not legal and things that are, you know, that perhaps are illegal because of, shall we say, overly reactive legislators you know, are in abundance. I referenced the ECPA of 1996. Okay. You brought up some interesting points. First of all, the amount of heroic hardware you'd have to put up to get enough power out of that quasi-shielded transmission line, the 130 or 330 volt AC three-phase transmission line that's 150, 180 feet high going across your farmer's field. The heroicness required to get any substantial number of watts out of that. The size of your coil, the size of your chunks of metal that are sucking up the E field or the coil that's sucking up the H field. That heroicness is huge by comparison to alternatives. The solar constant of around 1,300 watts per square meter tells me if I take a small fraction of those dollars and a small fraction of those square feet and I set up a solar voltaic system which sucks up sunlight and charges batteries, I think I'm going to come out ahead. Oh, I could send I could use a wind generator, a solar voltaic system charging batteries. By the way, pumping water takes lots and lots of kilowatts. You try to irrigate a few hundred acres of farmer's field, and boy, you're burning up hundreds of kilowatts doing it to get that much power out of the E-field and H-field from those power lines. Wow. I think it's out of the question. The amount of solar energy required to do that, or wind energy, is huge. So that's a tough way to go. But you have to look at the alternatives here. But you might, Howie thinks it's illegal. I think you might squeak by if you're quiet about it. But you're absolutely right. The leakage across the porcelain insulators when they got salt spray on them on a high humidity day is way above the kind of energy we're talking about that these farmers are going to suck up. And not that many farmers are that interested to go that far into the electronic requirement of solving this particular problem. Farmers are more concerned with what fertilizer and what pesticides, what feed, what seeds, and when I should plant, what the weather's going to be like. They've got a huge other set of problems to solve and just to stay viable. Keeping a farm these days is not easy. And the combination of a farmer who's got a successful farm and he's got enough time left over to tinker with all the electronics we're talking about, that's a wild individual. Who have I know, Howie, you had a couple of comments you wanted to make or questions. Go right ahead with yours, Howie. K2LIW and the TechNet.
The first thing is, Dick, number one, it is against the law to listen to a paid service. They've already said that if you use a decoder. It's also against the law to magnetically pick up the cable TV signal. They've actually been cased out. No, my comment originally was, Dick, was I used to be able to walk into a room and let's say somebody's listening to an FM radio, and if you move your body just in the right place, you can make the signal get very noisy or phase distortion. And I was just standing there, and I said, listen, if, I'm going to turn your radio down. And they say, how are you going to do that? I move my arm and the radio would go down. Just making that comment that you could actually sometimes find a spot where you put your body near an antenna or near a radio and you can create distortion or actually make the station get very weak. So your body does have an effect. It is absorbing the energy and it's also bouncing the energy. Over to you, Dick.
Dick, one quick comment. Yeah, go ahead, Gordon. Yeah, I was thinking of the hundreds of kV lines, let's say the 300 to 800 kV lines that often transit fields. I wasn't worried about the three-phase stuff. You're absolutely right to the example, but I think there's something to be said for the really super high voltage stuff that is single phase, that's putting, in fact, sometimes it's even DC. It's floating across your world.
Dick, was my comment copied?
Sure was, every bit of it. Don't worry, Howie. You're absolutely right. Theft of service is what it's called when you start sucking up signal from the cable TV system. And, of course, they want you to stop doing that. And some of those cases get lost by the guy who's doing the theft because of intimidation practices. If I started wrapping wires around a loose connector on the utility pole in front of my house in order to suck up that cable signal and then start using it as theft of service and watching that cable signal in my house, I've done some pretty active things that have left the premises of my property in order to create that theft of service.
And in that particular case, I'm pretty sure in a reasonable court of law, I'm going to lose. However, if I'm a non-cable subscriber, and if they're foolish enough to have a leaky enough cable system, that within the confines of my property, and particularly within the confines of my house, if I can set up an antenna system that picks up enough of that signal that I can watch cable TV free of charge, they have put a signal into my house I did not request. Very similar to what happens if I order a sweater from Sears Roebuck, and they deliver the sweater, and by mistake, they also deliver a one-horsepower electric motor. Legally, I own that electric motor. They delivered it to my property. I don't have to pay for it. I didn't ask for it. I don't have to mail it back. There have been cases like that that have been won. Well, you put that signal into my house that I didn't ask for. And as long as I'm not charging admission, I'm using it for my own private amusement, and I've used equipment that I built with my own hands to suck it up, I don't think I've broken any laws. And as long as I'm not being intimidated and I got a good enough lawyer, I might win that particular case if they were foolish enough to prosecute me. And they would only prosecute me if they found out about it because I'm a loudmouth and I start bragging about what I'm doing and I start inviting a whole lot of people over, if you know what I mean, to watch all these pay-per-view television signals or whatever. You got to be careful how far you push things like that. So these are opinions I've expressed. It's not the last word on the subject. Of course, most of you guys think it's illegal, and you're probably right. But if I've got a good enough lawyer, I might win that case under those particular conditions. Wonder what you guys think about all this. K2RAW in the TechNet.
K2KEY, I'll tell you about my experience.
Mel recognized? Anyone else?
I think the ethics are shaky either way. WQ2TDT.
They sure are, Gordon. But you got to keep quiet about it. You got to have a good lawyer. Mel, let's see what you did over there in Brooklyn. Those guys in Brooklyn are pretty crafty when it comes to signals they didn't ask for. You got it, Mel.
Hey, Mel, I just can't bear this. If it requires a lawyer, it means my ethics are shaky. WQ2TDT again, Mel.
No. I'll tell you what happened. Dick just made a little quip about, you know, if you order a sweater from Sears and a one-horsepower motor came along with it, do you have a right to keep the motor? Just said, well, I didn't order it, and will they come after you, and you think that you can keep the motor? Okay, tell you what happened. I get a thing in the mail, about four years ago. We have debited your account, your checking account, for $10,000. And I said to my wife, $10,000? Did we have that kind of money in the checking account? No, of course not. We don't keep that much money in the checking account. So I went over to the bank, and I said to them, what the heck is this all about? Well, this is what happened by mistake. We put into your checking account, it was deposited into your checking account, $10,000. And when we found the mistake, of course, they automatically had to send me a notification that they have debited the account for the $10,000. I said, I wish you would have sent me a letter that I had that $10,000 gift put in there, a $10,000 deposit. They said, well, what would you have done? I'd say, I'd come and I'd grab it. I'd take it out of my checking account. I'd write out a check and take it out. They say you wind up, you'd be prosecuted for that money. If you did get away with it because of the situation that, you know, while the the computers were grinding out, figuring out the mistake or where the money went to, if I would have taken that money, they said I would have been considered like an embezzler or something, or stealing the money, Dick. Or I would be, I'd be liable for it. What do you think, over?
You're absolutely right. Against the law, and I can tell you why.
No, I'm going to agree with Howie. I'm going to agree with you, too. To move money, it's almost always traceable, and a real act of direct transmission and reception is required, and it's all traceable, and the mistake is traceable. You didn't earn that money. You didn't deserve that money. Some other poor guy worked real hard for the $10,000. He wants that money in his account. He deserves to have that money in his account. There's both ethics, legality, all kinds of things. Radio is not like that. You generate a radio signal. It goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. When Howie moves his hands around, He's able to, by his reflection and absorption, he's able to make specific nulls in the radio signal being picked up by that handy-talkie in the room. Whenever I want to listen to this particular repeater in the morning, my handy-talkie has to lay horizontal